On behalf of UPTC, I would like to welcome the Great Neck Public School District to this webinar, especially our principals, our Board of Ed members, the administrative staff, our teachers, our students, and of course our parents. We will cover a little bit about the history of anti-Asian hate and discrimination. We'll talk a little bit about our current affairs, how a bystander can help somebody. And lastly, we'll speak a little bit about, we'll speak a lot about how to speak to your children about racism and hate. We will have a Q&A session at the end, so please feel free to type your questions into the Q&A box. So tonight, we have two very distinguished speakers this evening. We have Ms. Joyce Moy. She is the Executive Director of Asian American and Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York. The City University of New York. She is also a community advocate, and she was a former law professor. So we're very lucky to have her. We also have Dr. Catherine Ma, who is the Associate Professor of Psychology in the Department of Behavioral Science and Human Services at Kingsborough Community College, the University of New York. So before we begin the formal part of our program, I would like to recognize Mr. Wayne Wilk, who is the North Hempstead Town Clerk, who is in attendance and I would really like to invite him to say a few words.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be a part of this meeting tonight. I've had the good fortune in recent weeks it's my honor, not good fortune, because having these rallies and having so many of these conversations is a necessary part of living these days, but it shouldn't be, quite frankly. So I have been a participant in many of these rallies and events of recent weeks, and it's my fervent hope that we soon get to the point where we don't have to hold these events any longer, because we've gotten past this anti-Asian violence, which is all too prevalent in our society these days. In the past year, there have been approximately 3,800 documented cases of anti-Asian violence. And it's been all across the country. And if you think about it, that's over 10 incidences a day. And those are the ones that are reported. You know, we know that there are so many untold numbers of harassment and intimidation and even violence that are just not reported. So we know that this is a major problem in our society today. And I think we all can trace, you know, some of the causes of it. But we all know that it's just plain wrong and that there's no excuse for any of this. So what we're finding at this point is that, you know, so many people are just refusing to report these instances simply because of the fact that, you know, they've become so prevalent that people are afraid to even come forward in many cases. You know, we know that coming together to talk about these things, while I hope are no longer necessary at some point in the near future, but they're vitally important now because they do shed light on the true scope and the volume of the problem. And they give us the opportunity, quite frankly, to talk about what some of the root causes are. You know, like so many of you, my daughter is in high school. I know for a fact that, you know, they have these conversations, and there are so many things that are going on in our schools right now to try to address this from the root causes. At the end of the day, though, all the things that are learned in school need to be reinforced at home. You know, one of the things that I know psychologists and so many others have found in their studies is that hate is not instinctive. It's not something that we're born with. It's a learned response. And unfortunately, we know too often that it's learned in the home. It's learned from subtle and maybe even not so subtle slurs or slanders or attitudes that parents have, and it ends up in our children. And by the time they get to school, in many cases, those stereotypes and those biases are well ingrained in our kids. So having these conversations is important, not only to make sure that these conversations are taking place in the schools with the teachers and parents and students, but that they take place at home afterwards to reinforce the lessons, because that's really the only way we're going to get past this, I think, in any meaningful way. You know, the fact that we have to make sure that our children are not only attending rallies and hearing the messages, but then they're going home and they're living the lessons that they're learning. And it's incumbent upon all of us, I think, to join that and to make that a reality. Because otherwise, if the children are getting one message at school and a different message at home, you know, the confusion ensues and the hatred continues. So it's my hope that we can all, as like-minded good citizens, continue to impress upon our children and each other, quite frankly, that we make sure that they are learning the proper lessons and that we are living the proper lessons. We need to live our best lives as the people we hope to be, not as the people that are just out for themselves. And I hope that as we go forward, those lessons will not only percolate down to our children, but percolate up to us, to our parents, to our friends, so that we can, for once and for all, eradicate this anti-Asian hatred and hatred on so many other levels, because we cannot simply afford to continue to go down this road and to see the type of intimidation, the type of bias and hatred that is occurring right now. So I stand prepared to join all of you. I want to thank the United Parent Teacher Council of Great Neck. I want to thank the Asian American Asian Research Institute of CUNY. And I want to thank all of you, because the only way we get to the solution is for us all to be in this together and to remember that it starts at home, and quite frankly, it needs to end at home as well. So I thank you all so much for taking the time to be here, and I thank you for allowing me to be a small part of this.
Thank you so much. Allow me first to share our screen here. As was noted earlier, I am the executive director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York. And I am grateful for the opportunity to speak to friends, colleagues, and allies, and to share some information that may be helpful in your work in helping students, families, and members of the community to understand the things that we are observing. Much of what we're going to talk about today is not only applicable to the specific incidents of anti-Asian hate, but it will be applicable whenever we see incidents of hate, whether it is because of your religion, whether it is because of your race, ethnicity, your sexual orientation, ageism, and so on. So the approach is very similar in each and every instance where hate is something that we are responding to. So let me start off by talking about who are Asian Americans? This is actually a very diverse group of people in the United States. If you look at the U.S. Census definition of Asians, it includes those that are from the Far East, meaning the Chinese, the Japanese, and Koreans. From Southeast Asia, this includes folks from the Philippine Islands, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Laos, Brunei, Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma, and East Timor. It also includes, and this is actually the terminology that's used by the census, the Indian subcontinent. So they don't refer to them as South Asians, which is how we normally do make that reference in terms of our day-to-day speaking. But folks from the Indian subcontinent would include those from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And although it's not specified, there are South Asians from Nepal, Bhutan, and Sri Lanka who identify as Asian Americans. So you can see that Asian Americans, again, is a very, very large and diverse group. We speak different languages. We have different cultures. We have different religion. And so only in America are all of these people looked at as one ethnic group. There has been a history of violence and scapegoating against Asians throughout the centuries. It didn't just start today. It just did not start with the last administration coining phrases like Kung Flu and saying that China gave us the virus. This was something that emanated from the very beginning of this country. Oftentimes, it was a result of the fact that the Chinese and other groups were brought into the United States to answer labor conditions and labor needs of this country. For example, after the emancipation of Black slaves, the Chinese workers were brought in to fill the gap for labor because freed slaves refused to work for nothing. There were other times throughout history when Asian labor was brought in because the labor force that was in this country either refused to work or demanded wages that were too high. The Asians that came here to work had no understanding of what was happening and how they were being utilized in this country to act as a wedge between the economic powers and the labor force in the United States. They were caught in the middle, and that was the beginning of that scapegoating that we saw, because the politicians, the leadership who failed to act and failed to give satisfaction to the population that was here turned to scapegoating the Asians that were here and that they brought in. The Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which ran all the way through 1943, preventing my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and even my father from becoming a U.S. citizen, was put into effect shortly after the Depression of 1873 in this country. The railroad connecting the east and west part of the United States was completed in 1869. And shortly thereafter, the Depression, the economic conditions happened in the United States. And what did our leadership do? They chose to scapegoat the Chinese, saying that the Chinese was the reason that people could not find jobs, that they were the reason that wages were low, when in fact, it was the competition for jobs that made those wages low. There were only two Chinese people in this country at that time per 100,000 other people. We could not possibly have been the reason that wages were forced downward all over this country. So as another aspect of this particular set of legislations, there was also an attempt to deny Chinese citizens, Chinese who were born in this country, U.S. citizenship. The case of Wong Kim Ark is a case where the Chinese community pooled their funds together and brought the fight all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the principle that was established that all persons born in the United States are citizens was established because of that case. So all of us, Irish, Italian, Jewish, whatever your background is, have this birthright citizenship. Also, another major part of history and in terms of the development of attitudes towards the Asians in this country came out of the Executive Order 9066, which was signed in 1942. This caused Japanese Americans, two-thirds of whom were U.S. citizens, to be rounded up and put into internment camps. These were not summer camps. These were horrible conditions. There were members of the NAACP who visited these camps and found that the conditions were deplorable. They documented the fact that elderly Japanese and Japanese American babies died as a result of the heat in the deserts where these camps were placed. Also, we completely ignored the contributions of the Asians to this country, treated as invisible, inconsequential, people whose lives did not matter. The history of the 442nd Regiment, which was all Japanese, has been untold. Here was a situation where Japanese Americans volunteered and fought for this country in the European theater. This is the most decorated American military battalion in the entire history of the United States, all the way up to today. These are people that earned over 4,000 Purple Hearts, 29 Distinguished Service Crosses, and I can go on. But these are people that sacrificed for this country while their mothers, their fathers, their children, their wives were imprisoned. And we are the only group that this was done to. The Asians were the only group that were forced into these kinds of situations. And so again, this is nothing new. Another major turning point in terms of the Asian American movement in this country happened when the murder of Vincent Chin was committed in 1982. That's not long ago. There's a 27-year-old Chinese American celebrating his upcoming wedding, and he was beaten to death by two white American auto workers who mistook him for Japanese. The failure of our business leadership to keep our automotive industry competitive was an opportunity for people to blame and scapegoat Asians. And so they blamed the Japanese for taking away their jobs. But in fact, it was the failure of our leadership that caused that. The killers in this case, and they were clearly the killers, the evidence was there, were fined $3,000 each and served zero prison time. What does that tell you about what our lives mean? What does that tell you about whether people value our lives? The anti-Muslim sentiment that arose after 9/11 and the subsequent ban put into place by the last administration led to serious physical attacks and killings of Muslims. And also South Asians, such as the Sikh Indians, who were mistaken for Muslims because they wear a turban. This is all, again, part of the history of the violence and exclusion against Asian Americans in this country. And this continues because, again, we are being scapegoated for the failure of our American leadership to protect over 500,000 people from the aftermath, the impact of this pandemic and this virus. But rather than taking responsibility, they scapegoat. And that, in fact, is what is happening. So that's the history. But as was mentioned just previously, the current acts of violence against Asians is nothing new. And Mr. Wink had cited some statistics about what's happening. The NYPD has indicated that there's been a 1,900% increase in hate crimes against Asians in New York City since 2019. There have been nearly 4,000 incidents reported, and as Mr. Wink alluded to, this is probably underreporting. The majority of the attacks have been against our elderly, the most vulnerable members of our community, and against women, the people who are at the heart and the core of our families. That makes these attacks even more despicable than you would normally even think. So what can we do to support our Asian American students, our families, and our communities? And in fact, think more broadly, how can we support anyone that is being attacked for whatever reason, as we mentioned earlier? One of the most effective things you can do is one-on-one communications. Check in with Asian American students and their families, storekeepers, businesses in your neighborhood. Acknowledge and validate that their fears are real. And it's not shameful. They are not the perpetrators. They are not the problem. The problem are those that perpetuate these kinds of scenarios. I hear often from children and families that they feel that they are at fault, and they are not. And I can tell you that it does go a long way when you check in with the students and their family. They feel supported. They feel that folks understand that they are under a tremendous amount of stress. It has caused tremendous anger, fear, and sadness in the community. I can tell you that my own grandson, who's 7 years old, asked whether he had to change the way he looked. Can you imagine? This is heartbreaking. He also told me about his friend, whose mom is Asian and whose father is not. And he said that his friend was worried because his mommy looked too Asian, but his daddy was okay because his daddy looks okay. Listen to the messaging there. It breaks your heart. What else can we do? There is allyship, and that is when we stand together. Help us. Help yourselves. Help your other communities. Educate and raise awareness about hate. Engage others in conversations so that the dialogue becomes easier, so that we build these connections and this understanding and rapport. Put a face on it. It is very hard to deny when you are talking to a child, to a parent, an elderly person about what's happening to them. Show up and add your voices at events like this, at those rallies that were mentioned. Show your support. And you can do that by writing pieces, participating again in dialogue, organizing and inviting speakers. These are not difficult things to do, but they add tremendous support for those that are under attack. And you've heard mention of things like bystander intervention. I am going to speak about this in a very, direct but and cursory way. I would suggest that you get training. What I'm going to say here is not sufficient at all, but it's at least an introduction to some of the concepts. The Holler Back organization has put out some basic principles. I put the website here. And the basic principles are distract, delegate, document, delay, and direct intervention. It is key, it is absolutely important that you make sure that you yourself are safe before you attempt to help others. You know that announcement when you get on an airplane, put on your own oxygen mask before helping someone else. It's the same kind of thing. But the kinds of support and intervention that's recommended is that there be a distraction of some sort so that attention is taken away from the person that's being attacked, possibly giving them an opportunity to get away or to somehow get themselves into a better position to protect themselves. So among the kinds of recommendations they give would be to drop something, to shout out something, to call attention away from the person that's being distracted, being attacked rather. Delegate. If you're in a store, you're in a setting where you can tell an employee of the store, a security guard, or someone else about what's happening who might be able to intervene because they're in a position of authority, or they might be able to somehow help someone escape from that situation, do so. If it is safe to do so, document what's happened here. Video it. Call, make sure that you make a call to 911 or do something to document it so that the evidence can be presented at a later time. But again, make sure that you're safe to do that. Delay, what they mean by that is perhaps you may not feel comfortable or feel safe intervening when this is happening, but stay with the person, escort them, wait with them until the police come. For example, there was an incident like that that happened where a husband and wife attempted to intervene and actually ran after the perpetrator. And then they came back and stayed with the woman who had been attacked until the police came. That can be tremendously helpful to the person that's just been traumatized by this attack. Most of the time, we don't even know how to react because we are so shocked that somebody has hit us from behind or shoved us. We can't even process it. And then the last recommendation is direct intervention. If you have to, or if you feel safe to or capable of it, you actually physically intervene. Physical intervention may not necessarily mean engaging somebody in physical combat. We have seen instances of direct intervention by people who have just stood and surrounded the person that's being attacked, creating a human shield, in fact. And because of our natural inclination to back away when the odds are against us, the attacker is likely to back off a bit. So those are, again, I'm speaking about these in very general terms to just give you an idea of what is meant by bystander intervention. Sometimes folks are referring to this as being an upstander, but get training from professional groups to make sure that you are properly prepared to act. And so with that, let me just say thank you. I will be here along with our next speaker, Dr. Ma, to answer any questions that there may be at this time.
But my talk is going to try to give some concrete ways for parents or educators on how to talk to their children about hate and trying different ways to build bridges. So I just want to say a little bit about myself. I am an immigrant from Hong Kong, also a first-generation college graduate. I'm a social personality psychologist, and I've been teaching at CUNY for about 20 years. So this is not my first rodeo. I'm also a mom to three kids, 20-year-old, 16-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And I've written quite a few publications about different aspects of motherhood. And I've also done some chapters on mothering as a Chinese mother. And I just got a chapter accepted on ways to raise competent bicultural Chinese American children. So I'm working on that right now. And some of the current research that I'm doing at CUNY, I'm trying to figure out how introducing anti-racism readings to education majors who are actually going to become public school teachers in the New York City DOE. I want to see how introducing these readings are going to shape the way they view diversity, how they're going to implement it into their classrooms. So that's some of the things that I've been doing. But before I get started, I want to address the elephant in the room. You know, I want everyone to understand that we all have biases and we actually all harbor racist views. Some people harbor more racist views, some people harbor less, but we all have these biases. And we all have these types of views. And a big part of that is because our brains, we're trying to make very quick decisions and we tend to categorize information. So a lot of the decisions that we make is based on previous experiences, previous things that have happened to us. But unfortunately, when we do this, it tends to lead to a lot of biases and it also tends to unfortunately result in unwanted discrimination. But the key thing is that when we become aware of these biases, we can actually do something about it. And I'm going to just talk a little bit about what it means to be anti-racist, which is different from being not racist. Being not racist is a very passive way of, you know, not doing anything racist. And being anti-racist is something that's active. And with anti-racism, we are changing the way we think. We are changing the way we behave towards others. And a key thing to anti-racism is that we acknowledge that racist systems are actually the reason why certain groups are afforded privileges, unearned privileges, while other groups don't get access to these kinds of privileges. And then there's a few more elephants to address. It's very difficult to talk about race. I teach a psych of immigration class that I created after the 2016 election because I was filled with rage. And there are some days when we discuss racism, when I hear about the students talking about racist events that happened to them, it's very, very mentally exhausting. But as difficult as it is, as needed as it is, it does get easier the more you do it. And everyone can learn how to talk about race, you know, in an easier fashion. And also, I think a lot of parents think that if we don't talk about it, you know, it'll be okay, that it protects our children from learning about these difficult subjects. But not engaging in these dialogues, you know, talking about death, especially with the pandemic upon us, talking about racism, anti-Asian sentiment, it actually doesn't protect our children at all from these kinds of subjects because it's happening to them already. They know, they see. And talking about race is really an ongoing discussion, and it's actually a lifelong commitment. It's not something that you can check off a box after one workshop. It's not going to be finished after you've read one book. It's a lifelong commitment to be anti-racist. And, you know, one thing that I learned being a mother is that any unresolved issues I've had, you know, growing up, they were totally triggered once I became a mother. And with parents trying to figure out ways to talk about hate and about racism, any kind of unresolved racial issues that you have, it's going to make these conversations with your own children all that more difficult. So it's important that parents also work on themselves. And, you know, your attendance tonight is really a good step towards learning how to talk about these kinds of heavy subjects. So I thank you all for attending tonight. So I've broken up my talk into two parts. I'm going to focus first on what parents can work on, and then I'm going to focus on different ways to talk to our children about hate and trying to find ways to build bridges. So some things that parents can work on, you know, we know that children actually know a lot more than we give them credit for. So it's very important when you're talking about racism or hate to, you know, start early. I think infants as young as 6 months, they can see differences in like skin tones. So the earlier you start these kinds of conversations, the better it is going to be for your children and also for yourself. And, you know, be sure that you're able to use age appropriate language, you know, depending on how old your children are. It can start out simple when your children are young. And then as they get older, you know, these conversations can become deeper and more nuanced. You know, talking about systemic racism with my 20-year-old is much, much more different than when she was like 8 years old. And always respond to students' questions because children, you know, they're naturally curious and they're always going to have questions to ask. You know, don't ignore it. Don't brush it off. And if your child asks you a question and you don't know the answer to it, it's okay to tell them, you know, mommy doesn't know right now, but mommy's going to find out and then we can have a discussion about it afterwards. It's also very important for parents to challenge their own assumptions and behaviors, you know, and this is where a lot of the anti-racism work falls in. And this is difficult work. You know, you have to take a very close critical look at your own behaviors, at your own thoughts. You know, do you laugh at racist jokes? Do you assume that certain racial groups are more likely to be criminals? So these are like hard questions that we have to ask ourselves. And the best thing about challenging our own assumptions and behaviors is that our children are like little recorders and they're watching and they're learning how we behave. And, you know, that is very important for them to see. Some other things is to help children learn how to deal with being the potential target of discrimination. You know, I grew up in the 70s. And a lot of anti-Asian sentiment was the norm back then. You know, being the only Chinese kid in the classroom, being made fun of during recess, not having teachers to to like stand up for me. So, you know, just try to plan ahead if you can come up with, you know, witty comebacks. Like if someone calls your child some a derogatory name, you can say, you know, that's not true. You can say things like, you know, I don't know, something witty to kind of like put the focus back on the individual. It's also important to address your child's anger, because I think being made fun of can also lead to a lot of rage. So the mere fact that you address that with your child, that, you know, it can be something as simple that, you know, I feel very upset when people call me this. So you can just acknowledge that kind of anger. And as Joyce had mentioned, bystander intervention training is great. They also have a preteen training for ages, I think 8 to 12. And I've done the bystander intervention, and I think it's a great way to learn, you know, things that you can do when you see this kind of anti-Asian sentiment happening. And if you hear your children say something discriminatory, you know, don't hush them. I grew up in a time where bringing up any questions about race was considered to be like a big taboo. And my mom would like kind of hush me and tell me that that's rude. And it sends a very negative message to children, thinking that they can't talk about these kinds of things. So always discuss with your child when they bring it up, and always spend some time to correct any kind of misperception that they might have. It's also important as parents to broaden your horizons, you know, asking yourself these hard questions. How diverse are your circle of friends? And a lot of research has found that kids that are exposed to diverse people are actually more comfortable around others. They're more comfortable in diverse settings. And that is actually a big positive outcome for them. I remember one of my African-American students had asked me if she could ask me a personal question. And I'm like, sure, ask away. And she asked me if I had grown up around Black people. And I told her, yes, I did. And I asked her, why did she ask me that? And she was like, you're very comfortable around people that are different from you. And not all the professors are like that. And, you know, I grew up in a relatively low-income neighborhood on the Lower East Side. And I played with children of all different colors. And I actually didn't even meet any Chinese people until I started high school. So, you know, it's funny that living in a low income neighborhood actually prepared me for, you know, my career as a psychology professor at one of the largest public college institutions. And I think it's very important to affirm Asian identity and also Asian joy. Remind your kids that they are awesome just the way that they are. Try different ways to instill a strong sense of identity and Asian pride. There are many more books, children's books, teen books today that focus on, you know, the positive aspects of being Asian that, you know, I didn't get a chance when I was growing up. But, you know, right now there's many more books about that. Now, it's hard to bring up these kinds of heavy conversations. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of Asian hate going on every day in the news. And this can actually lead to a lot of anxiety and fear in children. It can also lead to a lot of anxiety and fear in adults. So I think it's important, you know, every now and then you check in with your child, ask them how they feel about these kinds of events. And also, you know, create a safe space for them to share how they're feeling. And that's a great way to also, you know, start these kinds of conversations. And as an adult, feel free to disclose your own fears, to try to end on a positive note. You know, there are some times when I tell my kids, you know, I also feel afraid of being outside by myself because of all these attacks against Asian people. But I still believe that, you know, this is just a rough spot and that things will get better as time progresses. And also raise discussions based on what they see all around them. You know, if you're watching TV, if you're reading books, if your child enjoys playing certain kinds of video games, you know, you can bring up things like, you know, there aren't many female characters in this video game? You know, how does that make you feel? You can also, as you're watching TV shows, you know, does that show accurately portray Asian characters, or does it rely primarily on negative stereotypes? Why are those stereotypes negative? And that also gives you a chance to, you know, bring up these kinds of conversations. So here are some ways to speak to your kids about hate and racism. You know, try to filter what reaches your children. I know it's, you know, we live in a very high-tech world, you know, but the sad thing is that the children don't have the same degree of life experiences that adults have in coping in these ways. So, you know, take a break from social media, you know, ask your kids what they know about anti-Asian sentiment. And that's also a good way to open up a discussion. Listen to your children and support their actions. I think it's important to be curious about how they're doing. A lot of times when I pick up my kids from school, I'll ask them, you know, what did you do today? Sometimes they're like, nothing. And then, but sometimes if I hit them at the right spot, they'll be like, you know, they start telling me about, you know, who did what. There's student president elections going on. And, you know, you have to like, you know, find that little time when they're open to talking. And then as a parent, you kind of like zone in on that. And the key thing is that when you're listening to your children is that be an active listener, you know, ask them what solutions they might like. And based on what they say, you support those kinds of decisions. So be an active listener. Another thing is that draw their attention to the good things. When something bad happens, help them see the people that helped. Help them see the people who intervened. Remember when that poor elderly grandma was hit and she fought back and she put her attacker in the hospital? You know, let them see that, you know, there are people that are standing up, that there are good Samaritans that are out there. And a big part of that is to model positive behavior, because our children are listening, they're watching, and being able to model positive behavior gives them a good model. Also, remember our stories of resilience. Racism is not new, unfortunately. We've been living with this probably for every generation. And every family has a story of survival, of how resilient they were. And unfortunately, this is also the time that we can also create new stories of resilience. Now, ways to build bridges. One thing that I like to do in my family is to commit to action. It's nice to read all the books. It's nice to go all the workshops. But if you don't use that information to action, it's kind of like lost, it's moot. So share ways you and your children can fight against injustice. One thing that I like to do with my children is that we donate to advocacy groups. You know, I've been volunteering a lot of my time with different organizations to help new immigrants learn English. As Joyce had mentioned, the bystander intervention training is an excellent support. And also, you know, when you have the chance to financially support Asian businesses, you know, do that. We've been going to Manhattan's Chinatown, buying like $200 worth of takeout from my favorite restaurant, Big Bong, and buying up a bunch of ice cream from the Chinatown Ice Cream Factory, and also tip very generously. And as I mentioned earlier, be anti-racist. And this is committing to actively changing the way you think and behave. And that's very hard for everyone because we're kind of like creatures of habit. But if you start these changes small, on a small scale, and you continue to do it, you'll realize that it becomes easier to change the bigger aspects. And acknowledge that it's racist systems, not individual groups, not individual people, but racist systems that offer certain groups unearned privilege while leaving others out. And also normalize talking about race. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, reading one book, going to one workshop is not going to, you know, cure all the ills of society. So normalize talking about race within your own families. Race should actually be a continuous discussion. And it's going to change every year. It's going to change as you as a parent gets older. It's going to change as your children get older. It's going to change as society changes. So try to normalize talking about race. And develop a sense of racial cultural literacy. Study and talk about the histories of communities of color. As what Joyce had mentioned earlier, it's never too late to learn about Asian American studies. And, you know, as if your children are older and they're able to take courses on Asian American studies, you know, encourage them to do that. Also, let your child see and acknowledge and how you are able to face your own biases. You can give your child an example of a bias that you have, and you can discuss how you overcame that. Unfortunately, I grew up in a rather racist household. When I was a young kid, I didn't realize how racist my parents were until I got older and, you know, went to college and learned more how to be a critical thinker. So a lot of times, you know, I have these conversations with my own children that, you know, this is what mommy used to think when she was growing up. But, you know, as she learned more, you know, she decided that those kinds of thoughts were not good thoughts to have, that they were actually racist thoughts to have. And it's important to be able to change those kinds of thought patterns. And also love who you are. I think in these kinds of scary, dark times, self-care is actually so incredibly important to, you know, preserve your own sanity. We can't care for others when we are empty. So, you know, make sure that you spend some time engaging in things that bring you joy, that help foster a strong sense of identity of who you are, a strong sense of community, and a strong sense of pride. So here are some additional resources. I'm happy to share my PowerPoint, and I've got my email if anyone wants to email me. So that's all I have for me. So I will stop sharing and we can start questions.
I'll start us off. I'm going to really put you on the spot here. I have a very tough question for you, but since we have a psychologist in the house, I would really like to ask this. So I'm very curious as to how we can change the people and their views on like hate, discrimination, racism, how we can change and reach the people who really need to see this. You know, so for example, we are all in this webinar. We have a rally scheduled. I will be there with my kids. But I feel like there's this population that really needs it, but I don't know how to reach these people.
God, that is such a hard question to start with, Julie.
That's really what I want to know. It's like, how do I reach the people? Yeah. And like on a more global scale, I mean, how do we get to these people and change their behavior?
I think
get them to like spread some Asian love and, or, you know, just love for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I think a big part of that is that, you know, we are kind of like preaching to the choir, you know, everyone's here. Has an interest in, you know, talking to their children, learning about, you know, ways to reduce anti-Asian hate. But I mean, think about racism as kind of like on a continuum. There are some people that are a little bit racist, and then there are like, you know, people that are going to the Capitol and like shooting people up. So it's like a long continuum. And we might not be able to help people that are at the Capitol shooting people up, but we might be able to help the people on this side. Like, and it's, I think education is an excellent way. Learning about Asian American studies, I think that is something that is key to understanding the rich history of Asian Americans and what they have done in building, you know, in building America. But there are some times when I'm talking to someone about these kinds of issues and I get very heated about it. And, you know, I really want to just scream out, you're just an awful racist. But I know that if I do that, they kind of like shut down and they're not going to listen to anything else that I have to say. So I have to kind of like slowly ease into that. Like, you know, have you thought about this? If someone did this to you, how would you feel about that? And you're kind of like questioning them. And hopefully you're kind of like planting little seeds into their head. And you might not be able to see those seeds, you know, grow, but hopefully maybe, you know, like down the line, 10, 20 years, they might start thinking, maybe, you know, maybe thinking this way is wrong. I remember, and like I said, we all have these kinds of stereotypes. And I remember in my psych of immigration class, there was an older white male student. And, you know, I had my own stereotypes about what older white men are. But in the middle of the semester, he raised his hand and he just wanted to share how talking about Asian American studies, talking about immigration, talking about many of the things that class focused on. And he was willing to share that listening to all the lectures halfway through the semester, that it actually changed the way he thought about his own behaviors and about his own views of people that looked different from him. And I was like blown away. And I think education is a big part of this. And if we start younger, you know, reading books about skin color, reading books about different cultures, I think that is a good first step.
Yeah, and if I may, I'd like to add to the point about education. If we knew all of our histories better, yes, and we understood that we have walked along a segment of the same path in becoming American, there would be a greater understanding. Black lives would matter and you would understand it. President Joe Biden said something that was very important. He said, do you think people are coming here because they want to leave their homes, everything they know? The answer is no. He said, my grandfather didn't want to get on a coffin ship, making a reference to the ships that made that long multi-month passage from Europe to the United States, where many, many of the Irish immigrants died before ever reaching our shores. He said, do you think they wanted to get on coffin ships to come to America? No, they were escaping famine and unbelievably difficult conditions at home. If we understood that, it would be different. If we understood that one of the largest lynchings in the United States was referred to as good by Teddy Roosevelt before he became president, and we understood that the people that were lynched were Italian, treated as subhuman, treated as criminal elements because they were Italian, because they were Catholic, we might then begin to understand that perhaps Black Lives Matter and that anti-Asian hate is unacceptable. You know, so there are lots of stories like that, and our children don't learn about this. We don't walk in one another's shoes. The qualities of empathy is one of the things that is going to really help the future generation. And it is heartening to see young people stepping up and showing that allyship, joining the marches and so on. So it does begin with education.
What would you recommend to those of us who teach elementary school, specifically those in upper elementary grades who are likely aware of some of the atrocities against AAPI community?
Well, I personally, you know, and again, I grew up and I'm the fourth generation of my family in the United States. My children are fifth and my grandchildren are sixth generations. And I know from my own education that I learned little to nothing about anyone that again, to learn about what has happened historically, and we can do this in an age-appropriate way, to talk about the fact that this country has received immigrants and to talk specifically about the contributions of these various groups to the building of America and the multiple positive aspects of their culture that have been incorporated into American culture itself, paving the way for young children to understand and value people from other cultures and backgrounds. You know, and so when people begin to value other people, they will begin to see the attacks that are taking place as atrocities. You know, if we model, as Catherine said, the kinds of behaviors that we want to see, it will make a difference. When you show up and members of the community see who it is that is standing up against these issues, it will begin to change the conversation. When you see teachers that you admire, when you see leaders that you admire, when you see business people that you admire standing up and saying that this is wrong, you will start to rethink what you are doing. Your children are going to say, you know, and all of us have counted this. You tell your kids something, and the kids always say, yeah, but the teacher said. If they see their teacher at this rally saying that this is wrong, the children are going to question their parents, and that's going to make a difference.
And I just wanted to add to what Joyce had said is that I think we can infuse Asian American history into many, if not all, of the topics that are part of, you know, the core curriculum. You know, something as simple as current events. You just have to see, you know, what's going on in the news. And, you know, children are curious. They're naturally curious. And to have like their teacher address it, it shows them that these are important topics to talk about. You know, and I think it's very important for educators to also, if a student says something that's racist, to like stop and take a couple of minutes. It doesn't have to be, you know, a long time, but to just take a couple of minutes and address that in the classroom, because that sets an important tone for everyone in the class. And I know it's hard to control what students hear when they go home, but in my classroom, I always address any kind of misunderstandings, any kind of like eye rollings that happen on, I address it in real time in the classroom. And it sets an important tone that, you know, we are a classroom that is going to abide by, you know, with mutual respect, especially if our beliefs differ from one another. And then, you know, we take the time to like talk about it, to unpack it, to have that kind of open dialogue. And it sets an important tone for everyone in the classroom.
Okay. Yeah. That was one of the questions too. How do educators undo what parents could be teaching their children at home that is based on biased beliefs? So,
yeah. Like I said, you know, you can't control what happens after they go home, but you can certainly set firm ground rules that don't have any kind of negotiation, that you cannot, you know, disrespect your classmates, that you cannot, you know, say racist things in our classroom. And one thing that might be good for educators is that you create with all your students a list of kind of like rules, class rules that everyone has to abide by. So if it's a joint process where all the students are also, you know, coming out with these rules, that will also make it easier for everyone to abide by them, and also to make everyone be accountable for creating this list of, you know, classroom ground rules. Mm-hmm. Teachers have a lot of power. You know, teachers have a lot of power.
Yeah, one teacher was asking how can they incorporate Asian studies and Asian history into their curriculum?
I think it's easy to do so because they're teaching about social studies, they're teaching about global studies, that, you know, to just add a couple of readings to their curriculum. I was in elementary school. Only thing I learned about Asian history was, you know, we built the railroad, and that was it, one sentence, maybe one picture, but that was a, you can talk about, you know, so many different Asian American studies is very broad. And it's not just about history that happened 100 years ago. You know, it's still relevant to, you know, issues that are happening today. And you can just, you know, find different readings with the internet. It's so easy to find things that are age relevant based on the grade that you're teaching. I think Teaching Tolerance is one organization that is great. There are quite a few resources on my PowerPoint that I can send out for, you know, any of the educators.
Yeah, I would say that incorporating issues or incorporating information about Asian Americans in everything that you do is something that's really possible. For example, if you're talking about science and we're doing something on biology and we're learning something about how diseases are handled, you can talk about an Asian American doctor like Dr. David Ho, who was instrumental in certain therapies. Now that may work with older students, but there are other people in the medical field who have made major contributions to this country who are of Asian heritage. And you can introduce those kinds of stories about physicists, you know, about sports figures. You know, everybody thinks Jeremy Lin was the first one, and he's not.
He's not.
There was, in fact, a Japanese American who was a member of the team that existed prior to its name being changed to being the Knicks, right? So there are lots of opportunities where you can present Asian Americans. There was Sammy Lee, who was the first winner of a double Olympic gold medal in swimming for the United States. And so there are those opportunities when you're talking about, you know, anything in terms of plants, introduce some varieties of plants that you're talking about that are from Asia, for example. So there are lots of different ways to do this. Don't just leave it to Asian Heritage Month. I mean, I think it is wonderful that we have these times throughout the year that are dedicated to specific communities. And, you know, but that's when, okay, fine, it's Asian Heritage Month. Let's get an Asian to come in and talk about something, or, you know, or let's go get some fortune cookies, which is, by the way, it's sort of meant to be a joke. That's not really part of Chinese cuisine, for example, but it is Chinese American, I suppose. But these are the kinds of things that we do want to do these things and focus on these things, but they should be infused throughout the curriculum. We should be learning about Black scientists, about Black politicians, leaders, same thing with Asians, Latino. We should be seeing women in strong leadership positions, making contributions to all aspects of society. That's how we are going to learn that all people are of value.
And I think as parents, if you have the time and if you have the resources, you know, ask the principal or your child's teacher if you can come in and, you know, do a little lesson on, you know, Asian American studies. You know, since my children were in pre-K for Chinese New Year, I offered to do that for all three of them, you know, from the time that they were pre-K till they were like in eighth grade, or they asked me to stop. And the teachers loved it because they got like, you know, an hour to like zone off and do nothing while I'm teaching their class. And, you know, a big part of that was I knew that if I didn't do it, they wouldn't learn anything about Asian American studies. So I have a bunch of PowerPoints if anyone wants.
Yeah, I mean, you can share them with me and I'll link it to the UPTC website so that everyone else can find it there. There's a question, if my kid feels isolated by others intentionally or unintentionally because of their skin color, what can we do to help them?
I would say that we would need to help the child have to build their own confidence, to understand that they don't need the approval and acceptance of others in order for them to be somebody who is a person of value. I can tell you that when I was growing up as a child, there were only 105 Chinese that were being allowed into this country every year. And I actually never met a Korean person until I was in college because of the immigration policies. And I had, at that time, been called all sorts of names. I was the Catherine, the only one in school who was Asian. I used to have these experiences where people asked if they could touch my hair because they never met an Asian before.
Yeah, they love our hair.
Yeah, and so what happened was I actually, because of the way my parents brought us up, did not, I think, suffer tremendously from the point of self-esteem. My parents told us about the strength of our own culture. They also told me that I would never be American, that I would never be accepted as American. And it's a funny sort of thing because then it made it possible for me to say that it was okay not to be accepted, you know? And so I, in fact, beat my own path, and I, in some ways, became even more Chinese. You know, again, I'm the fourth generation of my family here. I'm the first generation born here. But I did not need the approval of others for me to understand that I was a strong individual, that I was capable of doing well at things that I wanted to do well at. And I think that helped. It's not easy for everyone, but I think when your parents feel a pride in their own culture and they're able to help you understand that you come from a special place, that you come from a culture that has been long admired in the world, and that there are a great deal of things that are important. I have come across friends and colleagues who tell me that their children are ashamed of them because they have an accent. I have a very close friend whose daughter actually crossed the street and walked on the other side of the street with her high school friends so they wouldn't run into her mother. And those are difficult situations. The parents cry when they realize that, that their children are ashamed of them. But you have to start talking to your kids at a very, very early age. You can't start these conversations at the age of 15. You have to start from the day they're born virtually.
Yeah, I totally agree. I kind of had a different experience growing up as the only Asian. You know, there were times that there were times that I just wanted to blend in. Like, I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to be the only Chinese kid in the classroom. But, you know, I'm cute, I'm funny. So it was easy to make friends, and I always had friends around me. And I think, you know, that acceptance from friends was also very important. With my own children, at a very young age, we told them, you're never, you know, the first thing people see you when they see you is that you're not white. So you have to be okay with knowing that you're Chinese, because you'll always be Chinese. And I think starting at a very young age when they were very little and instilling that sense of pride into them, they grew up very different than when I grew up. But, you know, I also didn't have parents that had the flexibility of work schedules that, you know, that they can pick them up from school every day, that they can, you know, volunteer to be in their classrooms talking about Chinese New Year. So it's a very different way of growing up. But definitely, even if your child might feel ashamed, there is still hope that as they get older, as they, you know, become more critical thinkers, as they learn more about their Asian heritage, that they will, you know, eventually develop a sense of pride of who they are, a strong sense of identity. So there is hope. Of course, I married a Asian American studies major. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's had some influence on that also.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. Someone asked, there was an incident at the playground where older kids were yelling at a four-year-old, run away, he has Kung Flu. What do you think is an appropriate response to the children saying these racist remarks at that moment?
You know, that's a Yeah, I would say to you that that's a tough one, partly because of the pushback that you may get from parents of the other children. I can tell you that one of my kids was subject to a bad incident, and the principal of the school tried very hard to just ignore it, but they couldn't, because yours truly went to the school and sat in front of the principal's office every single day until that principal saw me. And I insisted on seeing the parents of the kids that did this act. When I met the parents were very defensive, and they said to me, "I don't want to hear it. My kid would never do these things." And I said, "Let me just say something to you. I'm calling you in, not because I want to punish your child or I want to criticize your parenting skills. What I am trying to do is to prevent the discipline to prison path that I see coming. Had your child inflicted physical injury on my child, which is what could have happened in what your child did, you can bet I would see to it that your child was prosecuted and in the criminal justice system. But we are fortunate nothing like that happened. So what I want to do is to let you know what your child did, and hopefully you'll be able to talk to her to make sure that these incidents don't happen again and she does not find her path to prison." So sometimes it is hard for a parent to accept that their child has done something. Part of that is because they are concerned that it reflects badly on them. After that conversation, though, the mother ran after me, and I thought she was going to push me down the stairs. But no, she ran after me and she said, "Joyce, I want to thank you for that. I hadn't thought about what the real repercussions were. And I'm really glad that nothing really happened to your daughter. I am going to talk to my daughter." And so it resolved itself. But when people understand that you're approaching the issue with goodwill, and it is for the benefit of their children, those conversations can be had. I don't think I would walk over to those kids and say, "Hey, stop it," you know, or admonish them publicly, because in fact, that may embolden them. And in front of their friends, they might try to be even tougher than they were before and show off and so on. That's a natural response. But instead, I would say to them, "Please stop that. That's hurtful behavior. And I really don't want to see you get into trouble. That's not something that you should say to people." And help them understand that you're actually on their side. You don't want to see them hurting someone else, because in the end, it will hurt them.
Yes, I like that a lot. And I think the way I would approach it also is like I would approach if the kid said a bad word or something. You know, I would just say, "It is just not something you should say. It's very hurtful. It's not nice. You know, please stop." Adding to Julie's question, how do we overall help others accept and understand cultures other than their own?
Well, I can say to you that it really begins with being exposed to other cultures, right? And to understand that there are differences and commonalities. I find that whenever I speak to people from other cultures, there's a whole bunch of things that we all relate to. So for example, you can go to someone's house and their mom will be nonstop trying to feed you. And we laugh about these things. Yeah, my mom's like that too. If you come to my house, my mother will try to feed you constantly. And you begin to point out not just the differences in cultures, but the commonalities in culture as well. A lot of this also happens with respect to religions. And it's really interesting in terms of how much many of our differences are negated in some ways by the commonality. So I think it's important for educators to point out similarities as well as the differences in cultures. I certainly hope that the kinds of things that we've been talking about, the kinds of answers that we've been giving you, it's something that's really helpful. And these questions are terrific questions.
Okay. My concern is to address our children without overstepping and touching on conversations that our parents might not want their kids to hear for fear of upsetting or frightening them.
I kind of think children are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. That, you know, that they observe things, that they see how their parents behave. They listen to how their parents speak. So, you know, but I also believe that, you know, with all the topics, with all the things that are going on in the world, you can still find a way to use age-appropriate language in speaking with your children. And also, when you bring up these topics, it gives children a sense of a better understanding. Because if you don't say anything, if you don't address it, what they're thinking in their own minds is probably scarier than what the actual reality is. So I actually believe that it's beneficial for parents to bring it up. And it can start something as simple as asking the child, what do you know about this? And then, you know, based on their answer, you can start the dialogue there.
No, I think I had a different take on that question. I think this might be a teacher asking about whether they should be bringing up topics in class that the parents might want brought up, or the parents may feel that they or the child is not prepared to have these discussions. I know that we run into these kinds of issues when we're talking about sex education at various levels and so on. And so these really difficult issues on racism and so on is something that, you know, we have to honor, of course, our parents' wishes and not bring up topics that they feel may be inappropriate at this time, whatever that topic is. And perhaps the thing to do is to let parents know that you plan to have a talk about a particular topic based on current events, for example, on anti-Asian hate, and getting a sense of how they think in terms of how their children will take something like that, or, you know, receive information like that. And perhaps based on that, you can build. Or one of the things you can do, and teachers have a lot on their plate nowadays, certainly, but perhaps there are ways to prepare some information that the child can take home to their parent about what it is you plan to talk about in that lesson. Perhaps some tips about how the parent can carry that conversation on once the child gets home. You know, as Mr. Wink said earlier, what happens at home is truly important and can be a real extension of what they learn in the classroom. So I do understand how a teacher may not want to overstep and approach a subject that a parent feels their child is not prepared for.
Okay. And then going back to what Dr. Ma was saying, you know, when I had this conversation with my 6 and 8 year old, we just tried to keep it very age appropriate. I said, hey, if, you know, some people out there think that, you know, Chinese people, even Chinese people in America, caused the coronavirus. And I said, what do you guys think? And they were like, haha, we didn't do anything. You know, like, that wasn't us. Like, so then there was another point you made on your slide also about just having a witty comeback. And, you know, one of the things I know a lot of people say, and I've experienced this myself, is, you know, go back to China. You know, you don't belong here, that kind of stuff. So I said, you know what, sometimes there are people out there that hate people, and it doesn't matter your color, your religion, your, you know, hair color. And, you know, we made it really silly. We're like, they don't like your purple hair, and they'll make fun of you. So I said, what would you say if they said, go back to China. And they came up with some silly stuff. And so I said, you know what I would say? I would say, are you buying me a ticket? You know, like, are you offering to fly me back? Because I would love to visit. So then they had they were all giggling and they were like, oh, wow, we can get a trip to China, you know? So just helping prepare them. I mean, I know it's very uncomfortable conversation to have. You want to protect your children. You want to keep them safe. You want to keep them in a little protective bubble. It's like, do they need to know about hate yet? Mm-hmm. You know, but the thing is, if you don't prepare them, they're not ready for it when, that situation arises. It's just, I tell other parents, the reason why we have to do fire drills is because we have to be prepared. You know, I tell my kids, if you see smoke coming, you know, we got to get out. So it's, to me, it's just another thing we have to prepare our kids. And yes, it's unfortunate that we have to have this conversation, but it's just the reality of things. So the next question,
I think it's a great idea.
Which one?
I just wanted to say that was a great idea. You know, making it fun, you know, everyone's laughing and, you know, it takes the edge off of it. Yeah. So great job, Julie.
Thank you. I try. I have my moments. So how can children spread the message to their friends and their schools? Like, how can they spread the love and unity?
Well, I think that there are opportunities for children to do presentations, to actually participate in discussions. The older students can talk about these issues from the perspective of having a class debate. And they can lead the discussions on this in their own class. I think that students who are admired and student leaders that are able to be in these positions of being presenters, of inviting speakers and moderating the discussions with the speakers and so on, could really help set the tone among their peers. So for example, if you have, let's say, students that are interested in this topic and they invite a speaker and they're the ones that interview the speaker, I think that that goes a long way because, again, I think that their peers would appreciate what's being discussed because of the fact that it is coming from a student leader. So student engagement is extremely important. And I think that their peers will see that this is a topic that does concern them and should concern them.
Mm-hmm. And I also think a big benefit could be, you know, bringing in, you know, Asian American, Asian speakers into the classroom, exposing these 13 and 11 year olds to cultures that they might not know about. And, you know, it's also about trying to find commonalities. Food is a commonality that we all share, you know, maybe have like a cultural day where people bring in their favorite foods to share with their class. There's different, I'm blanking out on the, there's different kinds of Asian cultural centers that are online where you can have like an online tour that can, you know, be something that parents or educators can also incorporate, you know, as like a thing to do. So exposing people, because, some of the people that are most racist, they have very little contact of people that are different from them. So the mere fact that you expose them to these different people of color or communities of color, that's a great way to alleviate a lot of that fear of the unknown.
Okay. So two more questions. For the sake of time, I'm going to try to do this quickly. I don't want to not answer anything, but so it says, I think there's a tremendous gap on the understanding of identity and racism between the first generation immigrants and their children due to the environment and the culture they grew up in. As a parent and first generation immigrant, what do we do to bridge the gap?
Well, I would say that there is a real difference generationally, largely because, for example, your parent, whether they're Asian or some other culture, has generally lived in a country where it is a single group of people. So, for example, my parents grew up in China, and the only people they ever met were Chinese. When they come to the United States, they maintain their Chinese identity. They have no understanding about the history of race in the US. They have no understanding about the role that they have in this culture, where we primarily see everything in terms of black and white. It's a biracial culture. We are actually, as Asians, very often not considered at all in any of these discussions. So it's hard for our parents, I think, to grasp what's really going on. What happens then is that they may have certain experiences, as well as the messages that have been exported to, exported abroad that contain racial stereotypes. I know that oftentimes in Asia, people are exposed to movies and such that portray people of color very, very negatively. And so again, they may come here with certain ideas about certain people. It requires that we talk with them, that they begin to understand something about the racialized society that is here in the United States. I think it's incumbent upon us to bring friends home who are different than we are. I certainly did that with my parents. Julie, I think I told you that I was quite familiar with Long Island. I can tell I went to high school in Roosevelt, which is a predominantly minority community. At the time that I went, it was largely black. Today, I understand that there's a very large Hispanic community. So I am a Chinese girl that went to an all-black school and won a Spanish scholarship. Only in America does that happen. And my mom got to meet all of my African-American friends because that's who there was for me to be friends with. And it really changed my parents' perception of the community. There were boys that were friends of my brothers who walked me home one time when there was a lot of racial tension. And they did that because they knew my brothers. And they said, I don't think anything's going to happen to you, but we're going to walk you home to make sure you're safe. And my mother really appreciated that. So again, we have to expose them, just like we have to expose ourselves to different things. And it's a tough thing. Dropping into the United States without an understanding of the racialized society that we have here is really difficult. It's like coming from Mars.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's very hard being an immigrant parent and having your children be first generation in the United States. For me, it's a constant juggling of, you know, trying to incorporate both Asian culture and American culture into how I'm raising them. And it's a struggle. It's not always easy. One thing that we did with our children was that we got them all involved in sports, because sports is a great way to, you know, find ways to like integrate with other non-Asian communities. So, but it's hard. It's always hard.
Mm-hmm. The last question is educating students in school can be negated by parental actions and words at home. What kind of conversation can we get children to discuss with their parents?
So I guess we sort of addressed this a little bit earlier in terms of when kids hear something different at school than they do at home. I don't think that any of us are talking at all about having our students go home and contradicting their parents or challenging their parents and creating conflict. But I think it is important to have these conversations in school and for children to go home and say to their parents, you know, I learned about this in school today. how come you said what you just said? You know, and the parents may then have to think about it. They might be defensive. There's no way for us to control when that's going to happen. The parent may say, your teacher's wrong. And well, that's the way life really is. Your teacher's talking theoretically. You might get a response like that. But I think that if you have educated a child well enough to ask questions and to begin to investigate and look into it more, you've already done a very successful job of creating an individual who is going to be exhibiting critical thinking skills.
Okay, it is 8:37, not too bad for my first moderating gig. So I just wanna say on behalf of UPTC Great Neck Public School, we are so thankful for you both graciously volunteering your time, and thank you so much for the wonderful conversation, education, and knowledge you have imparted on us. Thank you so much, and have a good night, everybody.
You're very welcome. Thank you.